when you hear that music, it means that it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I have missed you all while I was out hearing about everything that's upcoming in television, and we'll get to that and a chat about what I saw and what you might look for. Before that, though, we'll hop into the post-apocalyptic, robot-heavy dystopia of the week in Elysium. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and that sort of thing for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm extremely happy to see all of you.
Yay!
It's wonderful to be home.
Got the band back together.
And I want to thank Audie Cornish from last week. How fantastic was that?
Pretty great.
And also, of course, our friends Gene Demby and Kat Chow from the week before that. How great was that?
Also it's great. Almost as if there's no drop-off at all when Linda leaves.
It's like no one notices in the slightest. I could just take the rest of the weeks off and no one would even mind at all. I was very glad to hear how well the show went. I enjoyed listening to it. I enjoyed listening to it as a completely uninvolved participant. I judged nothing. I was just super, super happy about it. And I was very glad to hear everything going well. Anyway, this weekend we all saw, I believe, Elysium.
Yes.
Yes?
Correct.
Yes.
So Elysium is a movie from writer-director Neil Blomkamp, who also did District 9, a Best Picture nominee from a few years ago. That movie was about aliens and apartheid, one might say. He is a South African gentleman himself. Mm-hmm. And it was about segregating an alien population and the inevitability of that backfiring on you.
And then Elysium.
And then Elysium.
Cost three times as much money and is one-third as good.
Yeah. Why don't you, Stephen, why don't you expound a little bit on what Elysium is about?
Okay. Elysium is set on a future Earth, I believe 2154, 2159, thereabouts. I don't got to get that exactly right.
Yeah.
And basically, it is set on the Earth of WALL-E, but with people.
So there you mean are giant, with real people instead of cartoon people?
Well, no, but I mean giant, on Earth.
I see.
It is a heavily populated Earth.
I see.
And
but it looks otherwise like the Earth in WALL-E.
It looks otherwise largely like with the stacks of cubes of garbage and whatever.
Gotcha.
And the 1%, if you will, the wealthiest of Earthlings have spirited away to a sort of space station called Elysium, which is a paradise where, among other things, they all have healthcare.
Yes. That did seem to be the underlying point, was the presence of good healthcare.
And so Matt Damon, as a resident of Earth, is trying to get to Elysium. The clock is ticking. He has 5 days to live. But how does he do it?
Yes. They do sort of set that conflict up in the first act.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that conflict sort of evaporated over the... it's amazing when you say the fact that this guy has 5 days to live kind of fades from importance over the rest of the movie.
Well, they gave him special pills to take to stave off the effects of the radiation poisoning, so we didn't have to worry about his deterioration.
Right.
It was kind of a love story situation
where
he got more aglow as the movie went along.
Yeah, yeah.
They also introduced the requisite adorable Moppet, who is also in danger, also has a health issue.
Right.
So it's not enough, apparently, that you need to root for the hero.
Right.
You need to root for the adorable Moppet as
right.
well.
Right. Who belongs to his former friend, not ex-girlfriend.
Childhood
exactly,
friend.
Childhood friend slash sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
What I personally think is so impressive about this mishmash of story with him and the radiation poisoning and the pills and all this stuff, then all of a sudden out on this space station Elysium, where all the rich people now live, you have the petty political squabbles of the Elysian government, including the president and the defense secretary, played by Jodie Foster with an accent I absolutely could not figure out.
Okay, I spent some time trying to figure out what the hell Jodie Foster was doing with that accent. My theory of what they were going for is that it's supposed to be because she knows so many languages, yeah. because there are so many world languages, it is supposed to be six different accents at once.
That is extremely generous.
Yeah.
And it kind of is that. My theory was something along those lines. It's a polyglot world up there on Elysium with the rich of all continents. But my theory is that the character description she got from the director and writer is probably about a line and a half long,
yeah.
or maybe three words,
well,
like evil defense
you don't,
secretary.
You don't have a mustache, but twirl it.
Sure. Right. Yeah. And so she did all this character work on her own. She probably went and wrote reams of backstory for this character and got all kinds of tangled up in this internal monologue that is doing its best to fight its way
Very
out
now.
From behind the Armani.
Well, this is the thing. She was hired for her ability to walk into and out of rooms frostily and in heels.
Yes.
Every single scene.
Which is so funny because normally that would not be her thing.
Yeah, I know. But with a frozen sort of rictus grin yeah. of a scheming quality
yeah.
just to show that she was alive. And she
it has been yeah. highly thoughts. Entertaining watching a lot of presumably progressive-minded film writers and entertainment writers bend over backwards to point out how clunky the class war metaphors in this film are.
Okay, here's my thing. I wasn't as big a fan of District 9 as many people were. I came out of that film thinking, you know, this was a really good update of Alien Nation, the 1988 mm-hmm. film starring James Caan and Mandy Patinkin, plus some vivisection.
Plus elements of The Fly, plus elements of...
That's what I mean. There's a lot of gore. And the thing about it is, I think it got overrated at the time because of its use of allegory, which makes it seem a much smarter film than it actually is. Because all science fiction works in metaphor.
Sure.
Even the schlockiest shoulder hoops and headbands, zappy ray gun science fiction is a comment on today.
Sure.
But allegory is the least interesting, the most didactic form of metaphor. So it quashes characterization. It forces plot into this very schematic, although let's admit in Elysium, very weird, truncated, like all kinds of different directions and things that kind of where we spent, as you mentioned in your post, Linda, we spent a lot of time not caring about things that we should have cared about because they were set up to get to another place. I think very smart critics gave District 9 a pass because of its allegory. I think we're finally seeing when it's blown up to this extent, you can see how paper thin the thinking behind it is.
My takeaway from Elysium, which I mentioned on Twitter and was surprised at the number of people who sort of snapped to this and said, yes, I think that was my sense as well, was the fact that it's much stronger at world building than it then is at storytelling.
Yeah.
Because to me, this world of Elysium, the idea that you have this 150 years in the future LA, and then you have that the very wealthy people have essentially abandoned Earth because it's become too polluted, too environmentally disastrous to live on, and also because that way they're protected from the poor people that they have, from whom they've created this massive divide of wealth. That world is interesting to me. The idea that perhaps you would have the equivalent of a deserted island that all your rich people go live on.
Yeah. A gated community in heaven.
A gated community in heaven. And the poor people still live on Earth and do the industry. And, you know, somebody was saying today, like, well, how come the missiles are shot from Earth and not from up there? And I thought, well, they would limit the amount of military they have up there. They would dump that stuff all down on Earth if it was all the same to them and they could still control it. Those, to me, are interesting worlds. What would be the effects of something like that? Would you have rebellion? How far could you go with this idea that rich people can have robots do everything for them so that there is no underclass? That's an interesting idea.
Right.
And then they start telling this story about Matt Damon, and I just got, first of all, lost. Because there's a point where he goes and talks to this guy about, I need you to send me up to Elysium so that I can get healed, I guess.
Well, they basically have tanning beds up there where you lie
Versace
down.
Versace tanning beds.
Versace tanning beds where you lie down and are instantly healed. And all you have to do is walk into anyone's house. No one will be home. And you
healing
lie down
tanning lie. Beds.
Yeah.
And there's a little scanner that can tell whether you're a citizen or not.
Right.
But then there's a little moment where I couldn't really tell, like, was he saying he just wanted to go to Elysium and see it before he died? Was he saying he could be healed? Why exactly is the guy fastened on this idea? Like, if you download information from a rich guy's brain, you could then get his money, like, from where? And what would you do because you're not a citizen? And the plot didn't really hang together. And then you start introducing all these elements of the old girlfriend and the daughter and the guy with the samurai sword. And it starts to feel like the whole thing is sprawling out of control.
There were a lot of disconnected threads in this movie. My biggest concern with the movie is that if you're going to make an allegory about things like environmental pollution low-wage employment.
Income inequality.
Income inequality, illegal immigration.
Healthcare.
The 1%, and universal healthcare. And you have built a world where perfect, infallible healthcare is available to the 0.0001%,
sure.
And everyone else can just die in the streets. You have to explain why that technology isn't available to everybody. Or
yeah.
You have a very black and white portrait of evil rich people
yeah.
I think hoarding that wealth.
I think that's a very, very good point. They do
point.
Never explain why this seemingly fairly simple technology is not available.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I had the reaction to Elysium. I did not hate it. I was fairly engrossed by it. I respected the reach of the movie. I don't think it grasped what it was reaching for,
right.
But I appreciated some of the ambition of it. I actually was sort of curious enough at the end of it that the next night I watched District 9, which mm-hmm. I had never seen, and which actually, Glenn, I liked quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I found that part of it is a comparatively very, very low-budget film, and the way the low budget is employed is very imaginative.
Yeah,
there's a cheapness to the feel of the sci-fi that I say in a good way. That
yeah.
It feels kind of garagey to
mm-hmm.
me
sure.
in a way that I liked. It's not, obviously, but there's a sort of a tactile, interesting feeling to these what are basically big shrimp.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Being present in this community that feels really immediate.
Even though they're
in a way that the Elysium being off in the sky did not.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it was more plausible that this aliens are hovering over Johannesburg
yeah.
is more plausible in the way that it's set up. And mm-hmm. I just found, particularly with District 9, especially early in the movie, I had no idea where they were going with it.
Right.
And that's very, very, very rare.
Yeah.
And I think that's one reason people responded so much to District 9.
I agree.
This feels much more formulaic.
Boy, by the time you get into the third act, for God's sake, if you don't know where they're going, you've
yeah.
never been to the movies in your life.
And I was impatient with it because it stayed on the planet much longer than I thought it would have. It stayed mm-hmm. on the planet for a good hour and 15 minutes
yeah.
of a roughly two-hour running time.
Yeah.
And I kept waiting for him to get on that ship and go to
which is weird, which makes it the opposite of WALL-E.
Right.
Which
yeah.
falls apart yeah. as soon as they leave the planet.
Mm-hmm. I found myself liking very little touches in the film. I like the designer skin. I thought that was a smart thing that they
mm-hmm.
did, where the,
yeah.
the rich people had designer skin. I liked the look of William Fichter's shuttle, which kind of looked like a Bugatti,
mm-hmm.
his red
yeah.
sort of sweet shuttle. There's a moment in the film where a robot gets blown to smithereens,
yes.
which is like, please don't make this the best scene in the film.
And then it is.
It's
and
the
it
best scene
was.
In the film.
Yeah.
yeah, yeah, yeah. I agree.
And the self-scooching chairs. Every chair you sit in the future automatically... because we farewell the tedium of self-scooching. But here's let's do a thing where we put out a memo to every kid in film school right now where we say you can't make a film where the climax is somebody sitting at a keyboard tapping furiously. That is not a climax for a movie
yeah.
anymore.
I would also add to that a climax of the movie that culminates in two dudes wailing on each other.
Well, sure.
The climactic wailings, I'm getting really a little tired of.
But
one more thing that I don't want to see in movies anymore. Plot points hanging on whether a character will be raped.
Yeah.
Can we just not with that? I feel like
well, that's more broadly the woman in peril kind of business, and it's very common. The way that you get the hero really super invested
mm-hmm.
is you put the woman in peril, and
right.
very often, not always, but very, very often, there is a lingering sense that not only might she be killed, but she might be sexually assaulted
right.
in some way. That's a very common way of building stakes for male heroes, and
yeah.
I agree with you.
Gigantically tired.
Sure.
I'm way over it.
Well, speaking of building stakes, if the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, were alive today, he would not show a computer monitor with the words buffering, buffering.
Yeah.
That would not be a source of suspense.
Yeah.
And finally, at one point in this film, the hero is handed a laptop and told to press that button. At that point, mm-hmm. Faustino leaned over to me and said, is it the enter button? And it turned out to be
the enter button.
The enter button. Yes, in fact, it was.
Yeah, before we
rag on this thing 100%, I would like to point out that some of the technical filmmaking is very nice. The man knows how to shoot a chase sequence and a fight sequence.
Mm.
And I really rather liked what, in her New York Times review, I liked what Manuela Dargis had to say about Matt Damon as the hero and his sort of ability to, without working very hard and without ever coming off as insincere, he's able to sort of, what does she say, convey a kind of essential decency, a moral decency, that he is able to sort of portray, quote, a strikingly contemporary ideal of what used to regularly be called the American character. And I don't think there's anything particularly American about it anymore. It's sure. just what we like to think of as good character. Sure. And this guy, when he smiles, when he looks put upon, when he registers those emotions that you want a hero to register in situations like the one he's put in yeah. this one, you really believe it. There's something about this guy as an actor that's never forced.
Sure. And one thing that did occur to me while I was watching this movie, there is a moment in this movie, and obviously we're spoiling lots of pieces of this movie.
But
this is, I think, is all given away in the trailers, too. There is a point in this movie where he's essentially implanted with a metal exoskeleton type thing.
Yeah, that's
so that then
early.
He's running around with kind of robot parts. There were moments when I looked at this with Matt Damon with his head shaved bald and his metal exoskeleton where I thought, this movie would be so much more effective for me if he just looked like a dude. If he just looked like a dude, he had hair, he had a t-shirt on, he didn't have the metal exoskeleton.
Instead of like an Iron Man that somebody had built in the
garage.
And
he was, right, and I actually didn't think, you know, very often when I look at something like Iron Man, I think, oh, that suit's really cool. I didn't think the exoskeleton was that cool either. I sort of thought it was mostly distracting to look at.
Yeah.
And I kept wishing that they had just played this as like,
An everyman.
Yeah. Which is a different kind of cliche. It's not that would rescue it from being a cliche.
If he were John McClane instead of Tony Stark.
Exactly. Thank you, Thompson.
I'm kind of a genius.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that John McClane diehard thing is so important that he just seems like a guy. And in fact, not to go down an entire Die Hard rabbit hole, but it's very important that they do things like they leave John McClane without even shoes.
Right,
right.
Right? Weaknesses, vulnerabilities. Yep. And to me, when you pump up the hero not having vulnerabilities,
you feel like
that's
they're
the opposite of what I want to be watching.
Right. Well, yeah, they're basically building up ways to explain away what is already implausible.
And I don't want him to be a robot.
Right.
I don't want to watch a robot fight another robot.
And they're trying to have it both ways by having him suffer from radiation sickness, so he's weak, and then he has to take the pills, which are magically, you know, if one is going to make him feel a little bit better than six, will make him feel super.
And structurally,
because that's how science works.
Structurally, do you understand what I'm saying when I say it really did seem like the threat of the radiation poisoning kind of goes away and becomes unimportant, because then ultimately the final conflict is really kind of not about that. Mm. That's sort of, ultimately, by the time he's at the end and he's making kind of big decisions about what he's going to do or not do,
that's not the thing that influences the choice.
That's really not the point anymore.
By that point,
and I sort of feel like, oh, so his radiation sickness is kind of irrelevant now.
Well, at that point, they're just busy shoveling on Christ metaphors.
they are.
And including a bleeding hand.
Yes, I noticed that too. And I will say that the second time I saw a woman running with a child in her arms toward some sort of medical help, I thought, okay, two in one movie with the image of the woman running toward the rich person's house might be too many.
Mm-hmm.
Might
yeah.
be one too many.
Maybe one too many.
Possibly two too many.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I liked, as I said in the post that I wrote about this, I was okay with the world building part. And I think when you build a world like Middle Earth, right, people get very wound up in the world building part, coming up with the rules for how the place works. But then you still have to, if nobody cared about the story of The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or whatever, it wouldn't matter that they built up this. Am I right, Glenn?
Sure. No, I agree.
And so I felt like this movie spent way too much time on the world building of this allegorical space in which to tell the story, and then proceeds to tell what to me is a really boring and disjointed story.
I did think, as much as I did not, and I felt the character was sort of a pastiche of other snarling villains, the bounty hunter, road warrior-esque figure who is hunting him down, who I had no idea was played by the same actor who plays Ficus, the hero in District 9, who is frankly unrecognizable from the beginning to the end of District 9, and then is completely unrecognizable as this bounty hunter.
With the samurai sword.
With the samurai sword.
Charlton Copley.
Yeah.
Charlton Copley, thank you. That's a really good actor.
Mm-hmm. He's a very fine actor. But they give him lots of room to sort of swash and buckle and be very funny with his South African accent. And there are all sorts of little South African jokes throughout this movie, which I sort of cackled at a lot.
I was going to say, I like
that he's sort of doing these shout-outs to
still
a hometown boy. Well, I mean, there's one of the aircraft that the bounty hunter guy, what's his name?
Kruger,
which is a South African name. He's flying a plane that's flying the South African flag. It has some sort of buck on it. I'm not sure if it's a springbok or a water buck or something else. But it's one of those antelope things that that the South African people occasionally point to as a sort of
things.
Yes. And there were many. Boiki is a South African diminutive for buddy, or you know, boy chick. It's a kind of that kind
Did
of word.
Did he say that?
He said boiki at least twice.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And
I mean, he's South African and so is Blomkamp. So it makes sense that that would all be in there. Right. But it's interesting that you heard that, because I would have just assumed that was character business. Do you
yeah,
know what
no,
I mean?
It's, Base those talk. Are those are all sort of real yeah. things. And it's he said lekker a couple of times, which is kind of that's great. That's rad. And that's lekker is an Afrikaans word for that's going. That's really well. I like that. You know,
Trigram, ladies and gentlemen. Trigram.
But
Trigram's
spend
got
some
layers.
Time in South Africa.
And I kind of, you know, we've been kind of ragging on this for, you know, it's sort of ham-handedness. But you got to remember, this is a guy who grew up where a mother might very well be carrying a child toward a first world medical facility.
Of course.
From something not very far away where,
but
you know,
just once per movie.
It's true. It's true. But, you know, the things that he's putting on screen will resonate very differently with the people he grew up around than they will with American audiences.
I think that's part of what I mean when I say I think the world building is promising.
Mm-hmm.
I think putting yourself in a space to tell a story about this massive income inequality is similar to putting yourself in a space to tell a story that was basically an apartheid story, which is what District 9 was. It's just a matter of, do you then successfully come up with things to do with these characters that hold together, that make sense, that, you know, that are coherent from beginning to end?
I just feel like this is such an imaginative filmmaker. I wish that this particular time around he'd made a better film.
Yeah. And I'm sympathetic to the position. I mean, I saw somebody tweet today, and I apologize for not remembering who it was, but that, you know, this movie is the equivalent of the Star Trek episodes where Gene Roddenberry would stop all the action to have someone stand on the bridge and lecture us about the Cold War.
Yep.
I think there is some of that, too. Sci-fi people tend to be people with sort of big ideas that they're trying to get their arms around. And I respect, like Trey was saying, I respect the ideas that he's trying to get his arms around. It's just a matter of, does it really work? And I think ultimately it doesn't really work. I don't hate this movie as much as some people hated it.
Yeah, I don't actually hate it at all. I think it's kind of a hot mess, but I enjoyed watching it.
I think that's a fair way to put it. I was largely engrossed throughout. I didn't sit there with my arms folded the way I've sat through things I've hated. I found it engrossing, just not successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think of Elysium or other allegorical films or District 9 or sci-fi or the idea of trying to get your arms around a big story in a sci-fi setting. These are all things that have come up today. Speaking of coming up today,
you've lost nothing.
I know. I am back from California. For the last 2.5 weeks, I have been sitting in a hotel in Beverly Hills at the Television Critics Association press tour, which is where the Television Critics Association, which consists of something like 125 people plus some other people who are invited by the networks, come and sit at a very, very long series of press conferences where they parade people on and off the stage to talk about various new shows, various new projects, various new things that they have coming. Sometimes they were executive sessions where the guy from HBO came and talked about the vision for HBO and where HBO is going. Sometimes they were for individual network shows like The Blacklist with James Spader, where he's like, it's basically a Silence of the Lambs ripoff that I don't understand how they don't think they're going to get nailed for the fact that it's a Silence of the Lambs ripoff, but that's okay. Anyway, and sometimes they were for more ambitious projects like Showtime brought a really interesting series they have coming up called Masters of Sex, which is about Masters and Johnson, and it stars Michael Sheen as Masters and Lizzie Kaplan as Johnson. So that's what I've been doing for the last couple weeks.
Now, you attended, if I'm not mistaken, 105 panels.
105. Now, those of you who've listened to the podcast for a while may remember that a couple years ago, I talked about the number of panels I had been to, and I think it was 80-something.
Mm-hmm.
And this year it was 105.
So you did, what, like 20 better? You're like a 20 better person.
Well, I don't know if better is the right word. More?
All right, stupidest panel.
Okay, there would be two that I would put up as stupidest panel. The first one, more of you will have read about. There was and Glenn will have read about this one as well. There was a panel right near the end for a PBS documentary about superheroes where there were several guys who are comic creators who, at the very end of the panel, my friend Alyssa Rosenberg, who works for Think Progress in the Atlantic and some other places, asked some fairly, I thought, easy questions about, is the industry a little bit stuck because there's not much representation of women and minorities and LGBT people in superhero comics? And they kind of gave a whole parade of frustrating answers. And, you know, a couple of these guys, as comics writer Gail Simone pointed out later, a couple of these guys, including Jerry Conway and
Len Wein.
Are guys who have created terrific female characters,
sure.
And she considers them allies. But on this particular day, what came out was a bunch of stuff about, well, if it's all about a message, then everybody gets bored. And,
yes.
You know, and of course, the other person on the panel was Todd McFarlane.
Yeah, you can't lump these two guys in with Todd McFarlane. Todd McFarlane is his own guy.
But the thing is, there wasn't a good distinction between, you would not have walked out of that panel and said, that's the guy who's really bad on these issues, and these are the guys who are really strong on mm-hmm. these issues. It was a panel that I think the discussion just didn't go the way you would have hoped. So in a way, it's a bad panel in the sense that I think they just didn't get at what they were trying to get at.
Right.
And they wound up making it sound like they just absolutely didn't care. There was some comment about trying to have female superheroes is like trying to have female medieval knights,
yeah.
like, because they didn't really exist. And it was like...
No, Jerry Conway went on Twitter after that to
yes.
kind of say, look, I screwed up in my answers. Mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared for this. You know, we were talking about superheroes as myth, and I would say something better if I had
right.
it to do over
and
again.
And I was glad he said that, and Alyssa tweeted that,
right.
and
right.
I think everybody's been really happy to hear him say that.
There is something to the fact that the superhero genre is a regressive genre. It is steeped in nostalgia. It is
right.
born out of nostalgia, so
right.
it looks backwards. And there are great female creators writing about female characters in the superhero genre, even in the mm-hmm. mainstream superhero genre. But the fact that I can tick them off on my hand mm-hmm. means that there's not that many
sure.
of them. So, I mean, a book by Kelly Sue DeConnick, Captain Marvel is great. Gail Simone is doing Batgirl and Red Sonja.
Mm-hmm.
Superhero Girl by Faith Erin Hicks is not mainstream necessarily, but it's a great book.
And that's the one that Jerry Conway said, that's the only superhero comic that my daughter will read is the Faith Erin Hicks because... it's a woman.
Right.
The
yeah.
thing that was interesting was this was a really good example of a panel that sort of goes in a weird direction because I think people are not, they've just come from Comic-Con.
Right.
So they're thinking differently from this panel, right? This is a group of journalists who the rest of the stuff that they're seeing that day is other PBS stuff,
mm-hmm.
not other comics stuff. As it happens, Alyssa's pretty knowledgeable about comics, but... my theory now, in retrospect, is that specifically Len Wein and Jerry Conway answered those questions thinking that they were answering them kind of against the backdrop of all the work that they've done.
Right.
So they were sort of thinking, like, everyone knows that I've done X, Y, Z. And given that you know that I did that, my answer would be A, B, and C.
Right.
And there was no sort of context for it in the sense of like, yes, absolutely, this is a valid question. I think it was just it was not a good discussion. And I think that I was really glad the questions got answered. And I hope they get answered again. But I was glad he clarified as
right.
well.
That's great.
So that was one.
And then, you know, that was over. And then you got to go see the panel about the show that I think you're probably most excited about this fall season, right? It's Dads.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah.
The Dads
I'm assuming
panel,
this is the other stupid one.
Yeah. The Dads, okay, Dads is a show that's coming to Fox. It is executive produced by Seth MacFarlane. He didn't create it, but he's one of the EPs. It stars Seth Green and Giovanni Ribisi and Martin Mull and Peter Riegert. And what you have is two sons and two fathers. And basically all four of the guys are to greater or lesser degrees kind of racist. And it's like... It's sort of supposed to be like that the dads are more racist and the sons are kind of like accidentally racist. Being racist is not the only thing they are on the show.
They're also misogynist,
like,
right?
There's also farting and, you know, other like things or whatever. The
so
thing
they
that
have,
was
so
attracting,
they have, they've got layers.
The now
that,
with farting.
The thing that was attracting the most attention on the panel was some racial humor in the pilot that involves, among other things, there's an actress, Brenda Song, who's an Asian actress, who winds up in this scene where they make her dress up like a manga character
mm-hmm.
to sort of charm this Asian businessman into making a deal with them. And it's really problematic. So we get into this panel and, you know, you ask these guys these questions. And in the morning on that press tour day, you had the executive session, which is where Kevin Reilly, who's like the executive from Fox, comes and talks about kind of the overview, things happening at Fox, answers questions about all different shows, his executive view of how things are going. And somebody asked him about Dads and this kind of problematic humor on Dads. And he basically disowned the pilot a little bit. He sort of said, I think the pilot is one thing. The humor will be calibrated a little bit differently as we go forward and so forth.
We'll dial down the racism.
So I asked, when we got to the panel with the creators, I said, Kevin Reilly pretty much said he expects his humor to be calibrated differently as you go forward. Do you anticipate it being calibrated differently? And they kind of went into this whole thing sort of saying it's not, you know, everything offends somebody and all this stuff. And, you know, we're not afraid to rethink it if something is off or whatever. The point being, when you look at network comedy pilots, you have to remember that a lot of them will change.
Sure.
But certain things about them won't change. And actually, the biggest surprise to me was that McFarlane didn't show up to kind of help with that panel.
Right.
Because he's a guy who has a lot of credibility in terms of saying, hey, you know what? It's offensive.
Sure.
It's creative.
He can talk that talk.
Some people like him. He can talk that talk. He's done it a million times. Both of these panels are less panels where the people are not smart,
right,
and more panels where the conversation kind of goes goofy.
Yeah.
You know, I never walk out of panels being like, I hate that guy.
Right.
Like, I just walk out of them feeling like the panel discussion didn't go well. And those were both panels that didn't go
well. Can I ask you a question about a specific show?
Yes.
The Mork and Buffy show. Is it any good?
Not yet.
Okay, what is the Mork and Buffy
okay,
show?
Okay, the Mork and Buffy show is called The Crazy Ones. It features Robin Williams and Sarah Michelle Gellar. And they are father and daughter who have an ad agency.
Look at me.
I love doing that. Isn't she beautiful? You have your mother's eyes.
Dad.
Do that thing that reminds me of her, please. Just once. It's so cute.
I'm leaving you.
That's it? That's her. Feel like I'm back in court. Take half.
Do not encourage him.
Yeah, it's a lot of his shtick.
There is a lot of his shtick. The best part of that panel was when somebody said, seriously, it was a serious question, said, you know, Robin, I think when we look at this pilot, there's a certain amount of drama and there's a certain amount of comedy. And it just shows us that nothing is sadder than the sad clown.
Nothing is more heartbreaking, right?
Nothing is more heartbreaking than the yeah. sad clown. And as you can imagine, this is sort of, he tried not to react. Like, right. He tried to act like he wasn't going to react to that. And then he goes into this lengthy thing where he jumps up to the side of the stage. And he's like, stop saying that. It hurts me so much. I'm the sad clown. And so that panel also went a little bit off the rails. But mm-hmm. The pilot's not very good. It has, interestingly enough, the pilot has Kelly Clarkson in it, who is right, yeah. sort of the funniest.
I want to change my image. Mm-hmm. So I'll do your commercial. Mm-hmm. But I want to sing about sex.
Ooh. We are so fine with that.
Perfect.
It ain't the meat, it's the motion.
This is a sex song.
I know. Isn't it fantastic?
No.
This is the new Kelly.
She's sort of the funniest thing in the pilot.
And remind me, who's the junior partner?
Oh, James Wolk.
James Wolk.
Okay, James Wolk. I'm going to tell this story, too. James Wolk, who plays the junior partner on The Crazy Ones and also Bob Benson on Mad Men.
Not great, Bob.
And was the lead in Lone Star. I met him at a party, and he was very charming uh-huh. and very nice. And he was very popular at that party. There were many people standing around waiting to meet him because he was very friendly and charismatic, and we enjoyed him. So, yes, James Wolk is in that. I also liked Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is a pilot co-created by Mike Schur, who does Parks and Rec, mm-hmm. and stars Andy Samberg, who is not always my thing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But Andy Samberg and Andre Brower. Andre Brower, who plays maybe the most progressive idea of a gay character that you're going to see on network television this fall, in that he's a tough cop who is sort of incidentally a gay guy.
Right.
Sort of completely not a big part of the characterization. It just happens to be the case. For television, that's very progressive,
yeah.
I'm saying.
Right.
And, I mean, there are definitely a few things on PBS that are really good. We had a great session with Billie Jean King about a documentary about her that's coming up. So cool. Such a fun lady.
Nice. How much Bethany Frankel-themed merchandise did you leave
good
with?
Lord.
Okay, so we go out, and we were doing set visits on this one day, and we had been to the set of the new Queen Latifah show, and we went to a presentation from Bethany Frankel, who explained that she also has a talk show.
Former Real Housewife.
Former Real Housewife of New York City, Bethany Frankel. And she explained how she's also going to have a talk show, and it's going to be like a bachelorette party every day. Doesn't that sound tiring?
That sounds exhausting.
The best part of that press conference was at one point, Bethany Frankel goes, I don't care about the press. I don't care about press at all. And this reporter, Roger Catlin, who I'm sort of friends with, gets up and just walks out of the room. And she goes, no, come back, come back. And of course, he hilariously comes back and sits down. But the minute she said she didn't care about press, he got up and and she sent us home with, let's see, I have a Bethany tote bag.
She cared so little that she sent you home with a tote bag.
I have a tote bag. I have a Bethany water bottle. I have a Bethany, I think, energy bar of some sort that she gave us, and a Bethany squirt sweetener. It's like liquid stevia.
Yeah.
I just want to point out that our producer Lauren is making a really impressive face at this point at the idea of the liquid stevia.
It looks
kind
of sweetener. It was kind of vomit suppressy.
Yeah. Stevia sweetener. I have a bunch of stuff. I have a little Game of Thrones figurine. I have
So I think it was last year, one of the head honchos was very defensive about Netflix. And this is before
This is my wrap-up question.
Yes. Okay. Once again, who asks the questions in panel? Me. So we're talking to John Landgraf from FX, who's the one who last year talked all about how he really wanted the press to hold Netflix's feet to the fire about ratings and all this stuff, because they were going to come out and say things were hits and you weren't going to have any idea how many people watched them, which is exactly what happened. And so when John Landgraf is giving his presentation, I raise my hand and I say, you know, last year at this time, you were sort of an early alarm ringer of the business about online-only outlets not giving any ratings information. And all of a sudden, he sort of said, well, you know, we have nothing against Netflix. And we feel like there's a whole range. And here's how he explained it. He said, over here, you have HBO on one end, like HBO and services like that, that are completely subscription-based. And they don't really have to care very much about ratings. And then you have in the middle basic cable, which is a combination of ratings-based and subscription-based. They get some from your cable subscription, some from that. Then you have network, which is mostly ad-based, so they care a great deal about ratings. And he said, then you have Netflix, which is way over to the extreme of the HBO end, where they really don't have to say anything about ratings at all. So I felt like his position had softened on Netflix. Which there could be a variety of business reasons for that, including the fact that Netflix carries a bunch of FX shows, which people then catch up on. I think part of what's happening, I think every network executive, every broadcast network executive was asked to give reflections on Netflix. And the most candid ones, I felt, came from Kevin Reilly, who is the guy from Fox, which, of course, is FX's sort of sister corporation, right? And he gave... Instead of starting his executive session and being like, now I'll take questions, he started his executive session with a lengthy PowerPoint.
No good.
Which, but it was all about measurement. It was all about audience measurement and how, you know, overnight ratings are increasingly meaningless. And he was really the one who said, you know, you have to remember that everybody's different. Some networks speak in a loud voice to a large audience. Some niche cable networks speak in a louder voice to a smaller audience. And his words, I believe, were, and then you have Netflix, which speaks in a very loud voice to an unknown mystery audience. So you can tell that sensitivity is still there. Sure. And I actually think the biggest reason it's still there is that these guys have to get up every day and read stories in the paper about how, you know, XYZ was down 1/10.
Right.
And they know that in the long run, once you count in DVRs, whatever, that may or may not mean anything. They have to get up every day and follow every little press
piece about
it. We're down
0.1 with 18 to 34. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They have to follow these. Whereas Netflix gets to be like, it's a hit. And everybody goes, well, okay.
Yep.
It's a hit. And they feel like, you know, I think especially if you're a network executive, that sucks. But yeah, that's a very good question, because it was definitely one of the themes of this particular tour was how they feel about this onslaught by Netflix, which now, of course, has Emmy nominations. And
okay, so in a month's time, we'll be doing our betting pool again. And you'll have an advantage over us, as you always do.
Yep.
But I will
always
be
do
horrible.
Terrible.
I do.
Yes,
I'm always the worst.
Too much information.
I'm always the worst.
Yeah. I did want to ask, though, Netflix itself does not present at TCA. Is that correct?
That is correct. But I don't know what the combination there is of they don't want to versus there's not time. There's a Hulu's been presenting for a couple of years, so we had a couple of things from Hulu,
right?
And we had some last minute additions of panels from Reels.
Okay, then
Reels, right. Which of course, when you get a bunch of really tired critics in a room and they're all hearing panels from Reels, you get a bunch of tweets that are like, We're listening to a documentary about Kennedy for reals. And it just becomes rather horrifying. But yeah.
So I guess my question was going to be, is there any scuttlebutt being kicked around among the people there about things? You know, this time last year when we had this report, we hadn't heard anything about anything except perhaps...
we knew about House of Cards.
I think we knew
about Arrested Development. I think that part of what happened is that people just didn't really know how seriously anybody was going to take original stuff on Netflix. I think stuff like Orange is the New Black, people just didn't know how seriously is anybody going to take that stuff when it's only on Netflix. And the answer turned out to be quite seriously in the case of serious TV people, but I don't think we necessarily knew that. But we will now, and that will all be important going forward. So, all right, so... That brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
All right, I got two things. One, got a surprise announcement in the last week that there would be just a bonus extra new album by one of my favorite bands, the Avett Brothers.
Oh.
Linda, you are a fan of the Avett Brothers, as we have
in
discussed.
In much the same way as I am of James Wolk.
Yes, exactly. Well, there is a coming out on October 15th, roughly a year after their last one, which usually it takes two or three, is an album called Magpie and the Dandelion. It is terrific. Actually, if you go to nprmusic.org and look for the Avett Brothers, you can hear the song in its entirety. It is called Another Is Waiting.
She's a rose, she's a queen, but she's staring at a magazine in the dark, on that path where they doctor every photograph. Another is waiting, she isn't saying anything.
The album is called Magpie and the Dandelion. It comes out October 15th. It was a delightful surprise. I just saw them at the Newport Folk Festival. I had no idea they had an album coming out. But that is making me happy. The other thing is two very unlikely BuzzFeed shout-outs. One I will talk about less. It is for our little podcast.
That's right. We were on a list of podcasts for every personality.
I was greatly, greatly pleased and delighted about that. Very nice of them. The one that I'm especially happy about was the one I really did not see coming. It is from a lovely little 2-minute video that they put up on their site called Why We Love Comics.
For superheroes, anti-heroes, and everyday heroes. For the mainstream, independent, and underground. Because we're first in line when Hollywood gets them right. And first online when they get them wrong. This is Why We Love Comics. For late night inking, for Xeroxing and stapling, and calling ourselves publishers. For Stan and for Jack, and Alan and Neil. For Maggie and Colleen, and Jerry and Mike. This is Why We Love Comics.
Maggie is my mom!
That's right.
There is a picture of my mom!
It's true.
After Neil Gaiman, which what could make my mother happier than to come here after Neil Gaiman?
I know. That,
just what a delightful, incredibly nice gesture to see my mom get shouted out among all these comics legends. It just made me tremendously happy. Anybody who is nice to my mother automatically makes me happy.
Right. Excellent. Good choice, Thompson. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Well, we were talking about TV old and TV new, mostly new, but some old. It surfaced today. The website Upworthy posted it, and it was popping up here and there in the social media feeds that I frequent, so I stumbled across it again. Craig Ferguson on Why Everything Sucks. Now, it starts out as a critique of Madison Avenue and how it fed into, over the years, a culture that discounts age and experience in favor of youth and inexperience, and then devolved into the eventual deification of same, which he says, he argues, led to youth and stupidity, and inevitably, in his analysis, to the Jonas Brothers. Now, this is a clever bit. He's a comedian, after all, and it is funny. I think it is probably fair to acknowledge that there are going to be people in the universe who disagree with Craig Ferguson's analysis of what, if anything, is wrong with our society.
Mm-hmm.
He is, after all, sort of an old fart, as are we all getting to be. And I think what we can agree on is that it is highly amusing to hear Craig Ferguson say the word youth.
What happened was that, in a strange kind of quirk of fate, youth began to be celebrated by society in a way that it had never been in any time in human history, because what used to be celebrated was experience and cleverness.
And frankly, if you have a Scots accent, then youth, I think, to the American ear, is the second funniest word in the lexicon, right after Gru.
And it started to be a fashion, and that grew, and that grew, and that grew, and that grew, and now that's what all the kids want to be. I just want to be young and stupid. But you know what? That's not what you want to be.
Anyway, Craig Ferguson, Why Everything Sucks.
Very much enjoyed Craig Ferguson. I'm a big fan. Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I was scraping for things this week, actually, because we came back from Elysium, which wasn't making me happy, and we saw Oblivion, the Tom Cruise post thing. And that, you know...
Making you so happy.
Which dystopia did you prefer?
If you had told me that I would have preferred the Tom Cruise Runs Around movie more than the Neil Blomkamp movie, I would have thought you were crazy, but I actually did. I think it's a trifle, but I think it's actually a more entertaining film. Then we saw Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, which, hear me out, here's a film that knows exactly what it is. It's got Famke Janssen just eating up the scenery as a witch, and here's the magic thing, 88 minutes long. Remember when films were 88 minutes long?
I do. Mm-hmm.
Gets in and out. But, you know, What's Making Me Happy was kind of a high bar, and this didn't really cross it.
The fact that it was kind of short.
It was kind of short.
It's made me happy by being not too long.
And really in on its own joke. I want to say that again. That was really, it knows what it is. But then, you know, to set this up, many years ago when the Earth was new and ichthyosaurs swam the turbid seas, I wrote a monologue for McSweeney's from the point of view of Aquaman, where he explains that he doesn't actually talk to fish and he tries to defend himself against his critics of late,
about
people
it.
Who call him lame. And then about an hour before I schlepped across town to come to the studio, I got an email from a friend of mine saying, have you heard this?
Aquaman, king of the seven seas, has f***ing had it with you, man. By Glenn Weldon. First off, I don't talk to them, okay? No, how it works is I command them. Period. The end. Command, as in bend them, you know, to my will and whatnot. F***ing A. Even the ones with actual for real brains, the cetaceans. If I want, you know, a pod of Burmeister's porpoises to ram the hell out of Black Manta's manta sub, that shit gets done. If I totally want, like, a southern mink whale to go hump a giant squid, its most hated enemy, by the way, I just go, and it's like show world down there.
So that is awesome. This thing out of the blue, this thing that's been on the internet for years, I think 2006 was when I wrote the damn thing, all of a sudden gets this performance by an actor from Richmond, Virginia named Scott Wichman, W-I-C-H-M-A-N-N. Had no idea it was coming, but, you know, when you are writing a monologue, one of the things you do with it is you go over it again and again, you read it out loud to yourself to make sure there's some kind of natural rhythms to it. And right. I did this many, many times, but I am not an actor. So this thing came alive to me in a way that it hadn't before.
It sounds great.
It sounds so, I mean, it sounds so good. He really nails that do-do-do-do-do-do in a way that is awesome. So we will link to it. It's not making me happy. It's making me ecstatic. I had no idea this was coming, and it just kind of was delightful. So Scott Wichman, thank you.
He saved you from having nothing making you happy this week.
There's that.
While I was in California, I worked my way through two series that I had been intending to watch that I was behind on, one of which is Orphan Black,
right,
which was on BBC America, and it is about a young woman who, I'll just say, plays a bunch of different characters in this series, and it's wonderful and really, it's fun, but it's also really thoughtful and interesting and exciting, and everybody who had been telling me how incredibly great it was right. And the actress who plays all these characters has won a bunch of awards, and rightfully so, and it's a really, really good series. So Orphan Black, that was A. B was Orange is the New Black.
Oh, my God. That show was so good.
Which I have now finished.
Wow. So basically things beginning with O and ending with Black.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. That was my criteria. And so basically in my hotel room, I could just sit there with my little tablet and fire up just episode after episode of Orange is the New Black. So I would watch them until I was tired, and I didn't want to watch them if I thought there was a chance I might fall asleep. So as soon as I started to get tired, I would quit, and then I would come back the next day. And I finally finished watching that. And it is really – when I started watching it and I watched the first two or three, which I did around the time that you guys did the episode that I wasn't here for because I was sick, where you talked about that show. When I watched the first two or three, I was interested in it. I thought it was good. But I wasn't necessarily completely sold. But by the time I got to about four or five, I was more completely sold. And the entire thing as a document is immensely satisfying. And I really enjoyed it tremendously. And I'm really glad to hear that they are doing another season of it because I'm very into it.
I've been painstakingly slowly doling them out to myself now that we're not talking
about
it. You
know, honestly, I doled both of those out two or three at a time.
Yeah.
And I support that, I think, having done that with these shows. And I'm doing the same thing with House of Cards, which I don't like as much,
nearly as much
as those two. But I actually am not sure that the 10-episode binge or 8-episode binge is a great way to take in a piece of art like that.
Right.
They're both wonderful. Orphan Black I obtained on Amazon. Orange is the New Black, obviously, is on Netflix. So I do recommend both of those. Wonderful. And they are both making me very, very happy this week. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, MIGAKI. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. It's so good to see all of you. Thank you all for listening. And thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And we will see you back here next week.